I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Even though he announced he was running for president a few weeks ago at a press conference in Washington, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders made it really official on Tuesday with a rally in Burlington with sailboats and a shimmering Lake Champlain in the background. While he's an independent socialist, he's running as a Democrat challenging Hillary Clinton. Sanders' message was vintage Sanders, laying out his populist agenda, fighting what he called the grotesque level of inequality in the U.S.
Today, with your support and the support of millions of people throughout our country, we begin a political revolution to transform our country economically, politically, socially, and environmentally. Today, we stand here and say loudly and clearly, enough is enough. This great nation and its government belong to all of the people and not to a handful of billionaires.
Yesterday in Pittsburgh, former senator and previous presidential candidate Rick Santorum announced his bid for the White House.
As middle America is hollowing out, we can't sit idly by as big government politicians make it harder for our workers and then turn around and blame them for losing jobs overseas. Working families don't need another president tied to big government or big money. And today is the day we are going to begin to fight back.
While Santorum dropped out of the 2012 race, he did win some primaries and caucuses. And this morning, Republican George Pataki, former New York governor, announced on his website that he wants to be president, too. He'll be in New Hampshire later today for a rally. Joining us are Betsy Woodruff, political reporter at The Daily Beast. Her work has also appeared in Slate, The National Review, and The Washington Examiner. Betsy Woodruff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Domenico Montanaro, and he's NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. And Domenico, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Can I start with you, Domenico? Did Bernie Sanders do a do-over this week?
Well, Bernie Sanders, this time around, he's 73 years old. He's denies that he's trying to push Hillary Clinton to the left on some of these issues. But I think that a big reason for him getting in this time is because he wants to bring to the fore some of the issues of income inequality and some of these other things that he's been talking about for 40 years, really, going back to the days when he was Burlington mayor in the same town at the same waterfront park that he actually fought for as mayor. He trails Hillary Clinton by, anywhere from 40 to 60 points in polling. And he's not seen as top tier competition for her, but he's certainly putting some of these issues on the table.
Well, Betsy, just picking up on some of those issues. And he is a candidate that has used the word oligarchy. For instance, you don't often hear that coming from candidates, but he talks about income inequality. I think something that many people are concerned about. He talks about single payer. That has an appeal to some segments of the population. Talks about infrastructure jobs. Is he really extreme left from your perspective?
He's definitely the furthest left person running for president right now, without a doubt. And that's his niche. That's what he does. Sort of Bernie Sanders' MO is being the farthest left guy around. As you mentioned earlier, he's not a Democrat. In the Senate, he's a registered socialist. It's hard to get further left than that.
That's true.
It's also interesting some of the rhetoric that he's chosen to use. But on some issues, he finds things, weirdly in common with grassroots conservatives. For instance, he's been very critical of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. He's been critical of some of Obama's pushes on increasing the ability for the president to sign trade agreements. And he tore into Clinton for that. He said, I don't know how you can have an opinion on this issue. He said that earlier in New Hampshire. So it's interesting how some of these issues that we might traditionally see as very far left have overlap across the political spectrum.
Well, Domenico, going back to you, in Vermont, certainly has its liberals, but it also has its conservatives, and he's won pretty handily over the years. I think the last time he ran for Senate, he won something like 70% of the vote. Now, I realize Vermont is not the United States, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't think we should discount anyone who wants to run for president.
Oh, sure. The fact is, Vermont is not a swing state. I mean, it's not. This is one of the states that overwhelmingly has voted Democratic. For decades. But, Bernie Sanders he wasn't always beloved in Vermont. I mean, so this is somebody who couldn't, as the Burlington Free Press put on their cover the morning that he announced, this is somebody who couldn't even get out of single digits in some of his statewide races 40 years ago, and now, as you point out, is winning 3/4 of the vote overwhelmingly. He's hoping that some of the same tactics that he was able to use campaigning door to door, holding town halls, will be something that will help him on this campaign run. And we've seen a little bit of a boost for him in the polls where he's gone into some double digits. Of course, Vermont is right next door to New Hampshire, and that's going to be a key state as well for him. Picking up on something Betsy said, sure. I think it is interesting, this sort of spectrum of economics in particular, where you see so much overlap for with the far left and far right, really. I mean, the Tea Party, very populist, lots of rhetoric against banks. They decry the unemployment rate as not being real, all things that Bernie Sanders talked about. Of course, their prescriptions for how to fix those things are quite different.
Well, indeed. And let me just pick up on that and throw Rick Santorum into the mix as we talk about this, Betsy, because interestingly, he and other Republicans are appealing to working people, to the middle class. It seems like that is at least so far the focus of the presidential campaigns.
Yeah, without a doubt. Rick Santorum has been very open and explicit about the fact that he's really banking his presidential hopes on having support from working class, blue collar people. I think his book was called Blue Collar Conservative. It's an essential part of his brand and of how he presents himself. And what's fascinating to me about Santorum this time around is that, look, in 2012, he was a comeback kid. He had basically no money. He ran his campaign using, scotch tape and popsicle sticks, and he still won the Iowa caucus and basically came in second overall as far as the number of delegates. And that's because of his strategy. That's because he did so much to appeal, to quote-unquote everyday Americans, to people with populist concerns, to working families. And that strategy was so effective for him in 2012 on so little money that we're seeing a number of other Republican presidential candidates use similar rhetoric, particularly you look at Scott Walker, even Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, kind of are trying to make similar Santorum-esque appeals. So I'm very interested to see how that plays out over the next few months.
Do you think, though, Betsy, I mean, he has and has been associated with things like abortion. He's obviously opposed to abortion, gay marriage. He's been opposed to gay marriage as well. Can he leave those social issues behind him?
Absolutely not. Not in Santorum's case. Those social issues, besides his blue-collar populist rhetoric, those are an essential part of what he believes about politics. I would be totally floored. I would eat my shoe if Sanders stopped talking about the marriage and abortion issues. And that's another thing that's fascinating about the impact that he has on the presidential race. Santorum is not the only candidate who is very adamant about his opposition to same-sex marriage. Every single Republican presidential candidate is open and kind of hardline in opposing marriage equality for same-sex couples. So it's definitely a situation where the Republican primary electorate feels much more comfortable or seems to feel much more comfortable with Santorum-esque rhetoric than they might with more mainstream candidates.
I mean, Domenico, that there's a primary view of issues and then there's a general election view of issues?
Oh, no question about that. I mean, Republicans right now, where they could have as many as 18 candidates, it's a much more crowded field than what Rick Santorum faced last time around. And the electorate on both sides, when they vote in primaries, this is a pretty activist group. These are more hardline partisans. And the trick is for a candidate who wants to win in a general election, whether it's Hillary Clinton or whether it's any of these other Republicans or if it's Bernie Sanders on the left, they've got to try to be able to use their message. They've got to sell their message in a way that doesn't offend those independents in a general election who, don't want to be perceived as being too far afield on the political spectrum. The thing I find interesting about Rick Santorum, this crowded field is really what he's facing this time. That was not what he saw in 2012. In 2012, he was able to wrap up evangelical voters and appeal to them in a way where he really had that lane mostly to himself. This time around, you have a whole slew of people who realize that this is the way to win in Iowa, where 56 to 60% of Republican voters say that they're evangelical or born-again Christians. And it's not going to be as simple this time to get them all wrapped up. You know, the blue-collar message is one thing that Rick Santorum, of course, likes to talk about. It was a lot easier to make that argument in 2012 when he was running against against Mitt Romney, who was worth $250 million, and that was an easy way for him to find a path. This time around, he's trying to stress the new wrinkle is foreign policy. All the hawks are back in town. You know, it wasn't in vogue to do that in 2008 or 2012, but the rhetoric is much hotter this time. And Santorum is trying to say he has the most foreign policy experience because of his time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Remember, he served in Congress and in the Senate for 15 years. The problem for Rick Santorum, though, is he hasn't been in that position for a decade. And, you know, whether or not Republican primary voters are going to buy that or whether they are going to rather have some of these newer Rick Santorums, you know, the Rubios, the Ted Cruz's, Rand Paul's, they kind of are filling the space of what Rick Santorum used to be.
Well, is he a hawk? Is he a neocon? I mean, how do you understand his foreign policy philosophy, Domenico?
Oh, he's absolutely very hawkish. I mean, he puts things in very simple terms. He says, you know, look, it's very simple. He says, Israel friend, Iran enemy. That's it, right? I mean, this is like he's talked about how we need to bomb people back to the 7th century. He talks about how he was the broker for the strong Iran sanctions that now President Obama is in favor of. So he tries to pull toward that general election appeal with this blue-collar message, and then to say that you need strength in foreign policy, you know, stopping just short of saying that you need to maybe go as far as someone like Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, who you know, has talked pretty openly about being tougher on Iran. But he has a very hawkish foreign policy, for sure.
And Betsy, we're almost up in a break here, but it seems that for the Republicans, they're really jockeying to be in the top 10 so that they can get invited to the debates. And I think the first one happens this summer.
It does. Yeah, the first debate is going to be in August. And if you're not top 10, according to the most recent national poll, you don't get to be on stage. And Santorum was very irate when those rolls came out, because in 2012, he was polling miserably this time of year, and he ended up being an incredibly competitive candidate. However, as you said, there's so many people running, and it's such a crowded field that having a debate stage with, you know, upwards of a dozen and a half candidates on it probably wouldn't provide valuable information to Republican primary voters trying to decide who they want to support. So it's understandable, but it's also certainly understandable that Santorum's frustrated that they have to make a, you know, seemingly or arguably arbitrary 10-participant cutoff.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, when we focus on all things election-related, and that's Betsy Woodruff. She's political reporter at The Daily Beast. Also with us, Domenico Montanaro. He's NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience, and we want to hear from you. In fact, we have emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Domenico Montanaro and Betsy Woodruff about 2016 electoral politics, three people making it truly official that they want to be president of the United States. And let me just play a little excerpt of a Republican, George Pataki, former New York governor. He made an announcement on his website earlier today saying he wants to be president, and he will be in New Hampshire later today for a rally. Let's give this a listen.
Washington has grown too big, too powerful, too expensive, and too intrusive. This is exactly what the Founding Fathers feared. They knew all governments have the tendency to grow endlessly and ultimately to take power from the people and give it to themselves, the politicians. It is time to stand up, protect our freedom, and take back this government.
Betsy, why do so many Republicans want to be president? I mean, as you both have said, there could be 18 when all is said and done.
You know, I find it baffling. Being president is clearly a pretty stressful job, as you can tell by the hair color changes that that most presidents experience. So it's a little bit confusing that so many people seem to be lining up for the gig. I think, you know, the perhaps the best explanation is just that if you run for president, you get some publicity. It makes it easier for you to sell books. You might be able to up your speaking fees a little bit. You know, you get to go on TV and talk about your policy priorities. So in most of the cases with most of these candidates, it certainly seems a little self-serving. For a lot of these guys, they have to know they're not going to be president. But, you know, like if you're a retired governor or former senator and you're kind of twiddling your thumbs, you know, there's less interesting things you can do with your spare time, I guess.
I wonder how party leaders at Domenico feel about that. I mean, in a sense, people using a run for the White House as a Republican as a way to sell books, for instance.
Well, you know, I think that there is a major – there's a big reason why we're seeing more candidates this time than even 2012. I think the reason is because it's an open seat. And why that matters is that since World War II and since 1951, when you couldn't have two parties or more than two terms in office, it only one time has somebody – followed two terms of a president from their own party, and that was George H.W. Bush in 1988 when he followed the two terms for Ronald Reagan. It's never happened since World War II aside from that one time. And when Republicans look around and they say, history they think is on their side, they think that in this environment that President Obama's foreign policy will hurt him. They think that Hillary Clinton is beatable because of any number of stories and her past that they'll bring up. And they see an opening. They think that a Republican can win. And think about what that would mean if a Republican did win the election this time around. You would have Republicans with broadest majority in the House, most likely, since World War II. You would, if Hillary Clinton wasn't able to win, it's very difficult to see Democrats taking back the Senate because of where those seats fall. You would have massive Republican majorities across the country and in Congress and in the White House. The next Republican president could really get a lot done. Now, you know, Betsy's point is a good one, too, though, that most of these guys have to know that they're sort of an outside shot. But as Newt Gingrich said in 2008, why not run? Because, you wind up upping your brand and you wind up, with more attention. The problem for Newt Gingrich, he's one of the only people who actually wound up not being benefited by his run. Newt Inc. basically went bankrupt after he wound up running.
Well, in fact, I was wondering, you know, where is Newt Gingrich these days? But let me go back to you, Betsy Woodruff. I mean, do you think that's Bernie Sanders' reason for running, that to sort of up his brand? He doesn't seem like the kind of brand type, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I agree. He certainly doesn't seem to have sort of that eye on the prize in terms of perhaps a TV contract or a hefty book deal. My guess and just my instinct as far as why Senator Sanders is running is because he's probably pretty frustrated with Secretary Clinton. You know, he sees her as being too centrist, you know, too militarist, too friendly with Wall Street, too friendly with Walmart. And as we see more and more Democrats, both in the grassroots and also on Capitol Hill, pushing for the party to be more progressive and more aggressively progressive about economic issues, I think many of them don't see Hillary Clinton as a strong standard bearer, and Bernie Sanders has an opportunity to try to push her to the left. And what's really fascinating to me about Sanders is that even though he kind of gets, you know, he kind of gets eye rolls from many national reporters, he has an incredibly active and incredibly involved social media following. The politics subreddit of Reddit loves him. There's a significant sector of the Democratic base that is super energized by Bernie's message. And my guess is that that's what he's looking for, and he's hoping it'll make an impression on Clinton.
I mean, in certain ways, Domenico, do you think he's playing the role that Elizabeth Warren, I don't know exactly the role that she's playing, because she's not running for president, at least so far, but sort of keeping certain issues alive and perhaps pushing Hillary Clinton more to the left or more to the center?
Yeah, and I think it's part of what Betsy said, that I don't know if it's his frustration with Hillary Clinton. I think he wants to make her as good a candidate as she possibly can be on the issues that are important to him. And when he looks around and looks at who's pushing those issues, he doesn't see too many people who can make the argument. And he doesn't want Hillary Clinton in what I was talking about before, about how you want to pivot to a general election. He doesn't want her to have to try to pivot to that general election and think in the way that, her husband did in the early 90s to try to appeal more to conservatives and give in on some of these issues. So, you know, you got to think of it a little bit like a rubber band.
Right.
And, you know, she's sort of the ball in the middle and Bernie's trying to pull her a little bit on the left side while she's trying to look to that center of gravity to try to win a strong majority in a general election. Of course, he'll say it's not about Hillary. This is about him and his issue that he wants to push. And, you know, there's no reason to doubt him on that.
Betsy, a Hillary Clinton-Bernie Sanders debate would be a pretty interesting thing to watch, don't you think?
No kidding. I'm excited about it. I mean, we know we're going to have at least one Democratic presidential debate. I think Clinton is, I think she's committed to being part of it. And that's extremely exciting.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders is perhaps the least filtered of the presidential candidates, and the most comfortable sort of sharing his feelings and thoughts and emotions. And it makes him really interesting to cover on Capitol Hill. And it's going to make for great television when they do have their debates. Plus, he's much more of a personality and a character than we typically see in these debates. So I think it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
He said at one point, I mean, he did say, look, I'm not going to run a personal campaign. I'm not going to do personal attacks. And he did say in an interview, I do not have millionaire and billionaire friends. I don't know if that was kind of a veiled critique, Domenico, of Hillary Clinton, because she and her husband clearly do have millionaire and billionaire friends.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think that absolutely part of that is a slight at her. It's also about the rest of the field. You know, I mean, it's billionaire or bust when it comes to running on the Republican side, because if you don't have a super PAC sugar daddy or sugar mama or however, you know, you want to
sugar baby.
Yeah, I mean, like somebody's got to, after Citizens United, somebody has got to help you put ads on the air, do mailers, compete with these other candidates who are going to have a ton of money. And, you know, Rick Santorum's got Foster Freeze in his back pocket. That's why he was able to go as long as he was able to go against Mitt Romney. So, you know, everybody needs that in this environment now. And I think that Bernie Sanders, you know, that's part of his push, is that campaign finance is out of control, he'll say, that dark money is all over the place in politics now. And, you know, it's sort of a slight at Hillary, but it's also one of his big platforms.
But yeah, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times comparing the speaking fees that Bernie Sanders had earned. I think it was last year, a little less than $2,000. And looking at Hillary Clinton's speaking fees over the last 15 months, closer to $11 million. Sort of a David and Goliath situation there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, good Lord. It's hard to draw a bigger contrast there. I mean, geez. And, you know, part of that is because Hillary Clinton is such an important figure in American politics and also in American history. It's understandable that she'd be able to command a much heftier speaking fee than Bernie Sanders. But at the same time, you know, we're all aware of the allegations that, you know, some of the relationships the Clinton Foundation had with foreign governments and with businesses, you know, that there's a possibility that there were quid pro quos there. You know, none of this is totally verified,
of course,
but obviously lots of eyebrows are raised. And I think when you look at Hillary Clinton's speaking fees, it just kind of gives this sort of, you know, cold, prickly feeling that Bernie Sanders seems to be telegraphing. The fact that Hillary Clinton gives speeches for enormous amounts of money to Wall Street bankers, like that's a weakness that I think Sanders might be able to capitalize on.
Well, we are talking about the 2016 presidential race, such as it is today. And earlier this week, Bernie Sanders made it very official that he is running for president. Yesterday, Rick Santorum, former Pennsylvania senator, said that he is gearing up for a run on the Republican side. And this morning, George Pataki, Republican governor of New York, former governor, said that he wants to be president as well. And we realize it's a long way off, folks, but the races are beginning to take shape. Have you picked a candidate? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Domenica, let me just read an email from Liz, and this is actually quoting something. You referenced this, that Rick Santorum had said, and this was at a South Carolina Freedom Freedom Summit in Greenville. He said, if these folks want to return to the 7th century version of Islam, I guess referring to ISIS, then let's load up our bombers and bomb them back to the 7th century. And, you know, he said other things about other either foreign policy issues or domestic issues that, as I said earlier, I think will haunt him as he tries to kind of remake himself as a candidate.
But not necessarily in a Republican primary. I mean, he's got to, figure out a way to distinguish himself and get through that primary. It's, you know, you got to be able to push past all these other guys. If it's 18 people and Carly Fiorina, the one woman running on the Republican side, you know, so I think that's the game that a lot of these guys are playing. I mean, even with Bobby Jindal, I mean, you can see Bobby Jindal's been sending out a lot of letters on state letterhead saying Rand Paul is not suited to be commander in chief. President Obama is wrong for the office. These are all things that some of us might scratch our heads about and say, is that really ethically right? Should you be doing that? Boy, that seems like bombastic rhetoric. They're putting all their chips on the table to try to get through that primary.
I mean, would it be fair to say, Betsy, that this go around, that in the primaries, Republicans have to appeal right, Democrats have to appeal left, and then they go back to the middle for the general election? I mean, that has been the kind of modus operandi for a number of elections. Is still true today, do you think?
Well, Republicans certainly have to appeal right, without a doubt. The Iowa caucus goers and the New Hampshire and South Carolina primary voters are as conservative as they've ever been, and there's going to be a rush to the right on the Republican side. Some of these candidates, for instance, Rick Santorum, are already there. Others, like Jeb Bush, are going to be sort of hustling on over. On the other side, though, it's a little different because, like, no matter how many Facebook followers Bernie Sanders gets, no matter how much Reddit loves him, no matter how many former Occupy activists show up at the polls, Hillary Clinton's going to be the Democratic nominee. We all know this. You know, the only question is, how messy is that process for her? And does she do anything in that process that makes it harder for her to tack slightly to the middle in the general to try to pick up some of those suburban Ohio voters and northern Virginia voters and central Pennsylvania voters? So it's, in this case, as far as the situation with the Democrats, it's not the same as we've seen in previous years, only because, for all practical purposes, Hillary kind of has this in the bag. So that makes her life in some ways easier, but in some ways a little complicated.
Oh, well, indeed. And Domenico, I mean, she's been criticized mostly by the press by not talking to the press.
Right.
I mean, do you see this as a fait accompli, no matter who jumps into on the Democratic side?
Well, you know, there's no Barack Obama running behind her this time. You know, I think that's the big thing. It's hard to catch lightning in a bottle. Barack Obama did it. He had a message that was resonating for the time. He had the kind of coalition he wanted to put together. They had a plan for after Super Tuesday. You know, one of the things that the Clinton campaign soon realized was that they had no plan for after Super Tuesday during that primary. Barack Obama, one of the facts I love, his team, they were able to net as many delegates out of Idaho, out of the Idaho caucuses, as Hillary Clinton was able to out of New Jersey.
Wow.
So, you know, they had so many missteps along the way tactically that I think they've learned from that, and they're coming back to the table to see what they can do. But they don't have the Barack Obama running behind them. You know, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, who's expected to get in Saturday. Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island. Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia. You know, these are not seen as candidates who can muster the kind of grassroots coalition and money that President Obama was able to bring to the table. So she has a much more wide open path this time around. I think the challenge for her, though, with that, is when you're running in a primary that's a hotly contested primary and the media is asking you difficult questions about your own past or scrutinizing your finances, you're able to say, well, look, I'm not as bad as that guy. Look at what, you know, he's doing. Look at Tony Rezko or any of those other things that Barack Obama had issues with. Elections are choices. Unfortunately for Hillary Clinton, when you're looking at her, if you support her, the media is going to be one of her main opponents in a large way, because the media is going to be scrutinizing her record, as it should, because she's potentially the next president of the United States or running to be that. And, she's not able to deflect any of that criticism to say, well, look, it's a choice and I'm better than that guy.
Let me read an email. This is from Mike. I'll put this to you, Betsy. How does Santorum get away with the populist derision of quote unquote big money with a straight face while relying on Foster Freeze? And we mentioned Foster Freeze earlier. Is that hypocrisy or is that sort of just the way campaigns are run these days?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that Santorum has been particularly pointed on the campaign finance reform element when he talks about, when he sort of invokes this populist rhetoric. Most Republicans are comfortable with having significantly wealthy donors bankroll campaigns and be heavily involved in super PACs. That's not a populist area where you hear Republicans getting frustrated. My guess would be that if it ends up that Santorum sort of tacks that direction and picks up some of the Sanders-esque concerns about big money, he might argue something along the lines of, you can use the devil's tools to do the Lord's business, right? This is what we're seeing from Hillary Clinton as well, where she obviously has many, you know, great cozy relationships with the wealthy people and the Wall Street bankers that she's almost running against or running and giving this very critical of. My guess would be that Santorum can kind of make the same argument to defend himself on that point.
What do you think, Domenico?
Well, Barack Obama in 2008 said, we all walk in the mud when it comes to this issue. And I think that this is just a new reality of needing the kind of money to be able to last long term in a presidential campaign. And, you know, campaign finance reform is just not something Congress looks like it's interested in changing or fixing. Also, to the point specifically about Santorum, you know, he tries to talk about blue collar values, bringing back infrastructure, manufacturing, those kinds of issues where he'll be able to say, well, sure, you have a billionaire backing me, but what are the policies that I want to institute? And that's the same thing Hillary Clinton or any Democrat who's relying on big money will say, too.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We do this every Thursday morning, giving us a chance to focus in on election related issues and the 2016 race for the White House beginning to take shape with three people that officially announced this week. And then I just heard from our guest, Domenico Montanaro, that Martin O'Malley will make an announcement on Saturday. Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. Betsy Woodruff, political reporter at the Daily Beast. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Have you picked a candidate yet? Are you sick of the campaign, the race yet? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and today on the show, we are discussing the growing field of people declaring their intention to run for president of the United States. And again, our guests are Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience, and Betsy Woodruff, political reporter at the Daily Beast. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I see some email comments at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we want to know what you think about the race so far, how campaigns are run, and if there are any candidates that interest you, any ones that infuriate you, do join the conversation. Let me get Walter from West Philadelphia to join us. And Walter, go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just listening to your conversation and heard from a discussion I was having with somebody, with all the baggage that Hillary Clinton has, could there be someone on waiting in the wings who could be an alternative? And a name that popped up to mind was Michael Bloomberg. Here's a guy who's as far left as Jerry Brown, has a record, could self-finance, and doesn't have any of her baggage.
Well, Walter, let me see what our – I mean, there's been no indication that I'm aware of, Betsy Woodruff, that Michael Bloomberg is interested in running for president. Anything you know?
No, I haven't seen any indication that he would be interested in running for president. And I think if he did, he'd certainly have some significant vulnerabilities. Like the large soda ban in New York City certainly wouldn't play well in places like Iowa and South Carolina. His very, very stringent line on gun control could present problems for him in a general election. And, you know, on top of that, he's absolutely positioned himself as sort of an urban, tough-on-crime liberal, and particularly in the wake of Ferguson and Baltimore and a number of these situations that have caused substantial questioning about police-community relations. Bloomberg's record on policing in New York City would come under substantial scrutiny. Mm-hmm. I think that could be a problem for him in both the Democratic primary and the general election.
Let me read an email from Chris. He says, I'll put this to you, Domenico. I don't totally understand the question, but it says, is Bernie Sanders the Ron Paul of 2016?
Maybe he reads my Twitter feed because I actually tweeted that out.
You did?
Yesterday, 2 days ago when he announced it.
I said, discuss.
Let's discuss it. You know, the thing that kind of I found to be interesting about, you know, they both
You
kind
didn't
of quirk.
Just tweet us, did you, Domenico?
This was not just for – anyway, no, I mean, he's a quirky guy. He's older. He's pushing the party in a position. He's unbending on the issues that he cares about. And he makes the arguments in a unique way that is kind of unseen by other candidates. The other parallel that's interesting is he's kind of an ironic he's somebody who's ironically loved by – the kind of millennial generation. I mean, you see, you know, Ron Paul had a lot of young followers because they heard a fresh voice who sounded different about some of these issues and wasn't necessarily lockstep with the party. And I think that that's true for some on the left as well when it comes to Bernie Sanders. And he's become this kind of ironic hipster. Maybe he should grow a beard. I don't know.
Well, let me shift gears to you, Betsy, thinking of Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul. What is his appeal? And he's a really interesting candidate, it seems to me.
Yeah, for sure. And Rand Paul, I think, is the most distinct of the Republican 2016 contenders. He's the one who's put in the most effort to really distinguish himself and carve out a niche separating him from the other presidential contenders, particularly on criminal justice reform, on outreach to African-American communities, on sort of a more realist foreign policy rather than a neoconservative or interventionist foreign policy. He's done a ton of work, you know, since getting elected to the Senate, you know, back in the day, to really make himself different from the other candidates. And I guess the main question then is, do Republican primary voters want someone different? Or do they want somebody more in the hawkish interventionist mold that we see coming from, for instance, Marco Rubio and Rick Santorum?
What do you think, Domenico?
You know, I don't necessarily disagree. I mean, I think that those are all very solid points, and I think that that especially when you think about like Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, you know, these are guys who are seen as like a fresh face. Rand Paul has been slightly different than his father, and he's tried to work that balance a little bit. You know, he in going to South Carolina to talk about. In his election kickoff, he was in front of an aircraft carrier when this is somebody who's seen as mostly non-interventionist. Mm-hmm. So he's realizing what the Republican primary is, too, and he's trying to walk that balance. I'm going to be interested to see if he can do better than his father did and if they have as strong an organizing team around things like straw polls and delegate conventions.
Betsy, I'm assuming Jeb Bush is running for president, but I'm just curious about what is he waiting for, do you think?
Well, he's sort of biding his time as his super PACs raise money. There have been some watchdog concerns that Jeb is putting off officially announcing so that he can raise money for these super PACs that will then have, you know, more relaxed spending rules. He can raise more money when he's raising for a super PAC than he'll be able to when he announces as a candidate, because there are so many limits on how much individuals and groups can give to announced presidential candidates. So he's kind of running out the clock and building up a huge war chest, and that's going to be one of his biggest advantages going into the Republican primaries. Hillary Clinton is going to have money coming out her ears, and Republicans will argue that to be competitive, they're going to need someone who has similar fundraising muscle. Jeb Bush might be the guy who is most impressive on that front.
Domenico, let me read an email from Wiley. He says, these political pundits talking about Hillary Clinton as the de facto Democratic nominee disgust me. Her nomination is not a given. Bernie Sanders is a viable candidate with a huge wave of grassroots supports carrying him forward. He's in it to win it, saying he's in it to push Hillary to the left, disrespects Mr. Sanders and disrespects the reporters. Just watch and see. I mean, there's no question that he has passionate supporters. There's no question he has a lot to tell us about our political system.
Oh, there's no question about it.
Go ahead, Domenico, and then Betsy, you know, I'll let you jump in as well.
You know, and I respect that. I mean, I think that when people are passionate about a candidate, I mean, when we went up to Vermont to cover Bernie's kickoff at the in front of Lake Champlain, we had one woman tell us, "I've never voted for somebody that I'm in love with before, and I'm in love with Bernie Sanders. She said, I just want the whole world to be good." You know,
well, and don't we all?
Right, exactly. So, like, you know, the passion runs deep, and in a from a 30,000-foot perspective, it is one way that he's again like a Ron Paul candidate potentially, because I mean, every time I would write anything about Ron Paul, or you know, dismissing his bid as quirky or quixotic, I would get those Paulites, you know, on my inbox or on my Twitter feed, and I assume it's going to be very similar with the Bernie Sanders camp.
Betsy, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I think that's an amazing anecdote about the woman saying she was in love with Bernie Sanders, and I totally believe it. People love the guy. He absolutely has a constituency, but I think the Ron Paul comparison is dead on. Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul are both kind of crotchety, slightly cranky, sort of personally combative, passionate old men who have their issues that they really care about and are not necessarily good at reaching out to people who are more centrist than moderate, and unfortunately are not going to be president. Look,
but
it's possible. It is possible, given the laws of physics, that Bernie Sanders will be president, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I agree, but we shouldn't dismiss the real impact that he's going to have. I mean, you know, the
Absolutely.
Fact is, pushing Hillary Clinton to the left, you know, whatever, it may sound tactical, but what the point is overall is that he's going to have an opportunity here to get some of these issues, get her talking about the issues in a way that's mm-hmm. better than he thinks that she might be if he weren't in the race. And I don't think he thinks it's about her. No candidate can say, you know, I'm running because I don't think I can win. Of course, every candidate's going to say, I'm running because I think I can win. The playing field just makes it very difficult. Now, my mind can absolutely be changed on that. Mm-hmm. Let's see how things go. And, you know, we have lots of time and people have to vote.
Well, and there are, and we touched on them earlier, but there are a number of very specific issues that he's been, you know, very consistent on. And it looks like he's going to push those issues going forward. Let me get to, it looks like Wayne from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to note a couple of things. First, I think people are underestimating Bernie Sanders tremendously. I agree with the last speaker from the last email. I think he's in it to win it. Secondly, I think you're also underestimating the popularity of Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary is very, very vulnerable, right? I think she'll revert to form. By that, I mean that she's going to go back and try to reclaim the old Democratic Party based on the Southern vote. And that's a Democratic Party that Barack Obama clearly rejected and created a new Democratic coalition.
Well,
that coalition is very, very strong.
Yeah, let me just jump in here. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, Betsy, do you see Hillary Clinton doing what Wayne described there?
I think Wayne is absolutely right that Hillary Clinton is probably more vulnerable than conventional wisdom might dictate. It seems like every week we get a story that is, you know, for many readers, deeply concerning about the behavior of the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton's relationship with oil oligarchs and with former members of the Ukrainian parliament and her husband's relationship with really questionable actors in Russia. There's going to be so many stories about this foundation coming out, about the donations that they made, about, you know, perhaps correlations between donations to the Clinton Foundation and decisions that Hillary made as Secretary of State. Look, it is far from a given that if she is there as the Democratic presidential nominee, that she would become president. Absolutely not a given. And I think that's a very fair and important point for Wayne to make.
But on the issues, and that's what I kind of hear Wayne saying, is sort of going back to an old Democratic Party that might appeal to certain kind of voter. I mean, do you think, Domenico, that Hillary learned something the last go-round?
I think she's different than her husband, Bill. I think that there's no question that Bill was at a different time where Democrats had been out of power, remember, for three terms since Jimmy Carter when he ran. And they, you know, he felt that the need was for a Southern Democrat to be able to appeal to a center-right country. Barack Obama tried to be a transformative candidate. We've seen the demography of the country overall benefiting Democrats with a new wave of Hispanics, Asians, you know, African American voters being with where they are, and I think that that coalition opens things up for a Democrat in a different way than they were able to run, than Bill Clinton was able to run. You know, even in her 2000 Senate run, she didn't exactly run as the you know, the Senate or the centrist DLC, Democratic Leadership Council candidate that her husband ran as, trying to appeal to those yellow dogs and appeal to the center right. I think she appeals a little bit differently on family issues, on work life, on family sick leave, where she takes a little bit more liberal tack than her husband did. So, you know, but I take the caller's point that she is obviously vulnerable. When I look at polling numbers, though, what's fascinating to me is the favorability ratings of all of these candidates are terrible.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's really hard to look at an election before this where all of the candidates basically were not very well liked. And I think that we're seeing that in the interest, you know, numbers, in some of the frustration that you hear from callers on the kinds of candidates. There isn't like a huge satisfaction with the kinds of people that are running. And Hillary Clinton, who's come down from these sky high numbers from when she was Secretary of State, she's still she has higher favorability ratings than most of the Republicans. And she's basically polarized split. And I think it's that going to be that kind of grinding election that we're in for.
Betsy, let me read an email from Mar, who says, can you tell me who of all the candidates are providing a solid plan for dealing with the global climate change? She says, basically, whoever that is, they get my vote. Do you have an answer to that, Betsy?
I don't. We're not really at the point where candidates have started rolling out detailed policy proposals. And even Clinton has, you know, said that she's concerned about the influence of human activity on the change of the climate. But she hasn't rolled out anything super detailed or super in-depth saying what she would do if she was president to change those trends. And on the Republican side, of course, there's very little about the climate change issue besides sort of, you know, jokes about, oh, it's snowing somewhere, ha ha, climate change, that's not happening. That's the kind of rhetoric that you hear from most Republicans on the campaign trail about that issue. But, you know, to be fair, most of the candidates have not rolled out detailed policy proposals on anything, with the exception of Jeb Bush on immigration. He wrote a book laying out a pretty detailed plan that he would put in place if he was president to deal with that. But besides that, we're not getting super wonky on anything at this point, unfortunately, because that stuff's fun.
Sure, exactly, and that's such an important one. Domenico, about a minute before I have to say goodbye. As you mentioned, Martin O'Malley is going to make his announcement on Saturday. What should listeners know about him?
Well, Martin O'Malley was the governor of Maryland, and he really bases himself in Baltimore. And his policing policies were something that wound up getting some attention when he went back to Baltimore during what had happened there with the police issue in Baltimore. And, you know, he's somebody who, again, is going to try to bring up some of these issues that maybe he thinks some candidates are not going to talk about as strongly. He can talk about his executive experience. One of the knocks on him was that the healthcare exchange in Maryland did not do so well. You know, whether or not he's going to be able to build a coalition around that is going to be interesting to see.
Well, stay tuned, and my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He's NPR's lead editor for politics and digital audience. Betsy Woodruff, thank you very much as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And she's political reporter at The Daily Beast. Her work has also appeared on Slate, The National Review, and The Washington Examiner. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Tell us what you think of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also download podcasts of Radio Times. You can follow us on Facebook, and you can also do the same thing on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowin. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.